You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Leanne Morose. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, October 16th, 2018.
It is disguised as a civil rights statute. It targets the core of Roe v. Wade by banning a woman's right to make her own decision.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill appealed to the Supreme Court on Friday. Hill is asking the nation's highest court to review proposed state restrictions on abortion. WFHB correspondent Annie Aguiar speaks with IU law professor Don Johnson about the state law, which has twice been struck down by district appeals courts, later in the program. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, John Sommerlott speaks about IU's founding in the 1800s in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
The cities of Bloomington and Columbus announced a multi-million dollar deal to encourage entrepreneurial startups this afternoon. Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton, Columbus Mayor Jim Linup, Dimension Mill founder Pat East, Columbus Chamber of Commerce President Cindy Frey, and Bloomington Communications Director Yael Cassander made the announcement via Facebook Live this afternoon. Dimension Mill and the Columbus chapter have reportedly put together $1 million to match a $1.5 million venture capital investment by Elevate Ventures. Private investors, including some of the area's biggest employers, have helped Dimension Mill put together its $500,000 share of the funding. Both the Columbus Chamber and Dimension Mill are expected to contribute $500,000 each under a legal agreement with Elevate Ventures. The partnership will fund a full-time entrepreneurial position from Elevate Ventures. That person is expected to find companies between the two communities to invest in and grow. The official launch of the partnership will happen on December 6th at Hard Truth Hills in Nashville. The joint venture will be overseen by a joint committee consisting of two representatives each from Bloomington and Columbus and one from Elevate Ventures. The city of Bloomington has spent more than $4 million renovating Dimension Mill into a co-work and tech entrepreneurial center. Dimension Mill is expected to open on November 15th.
The Richmond Bean Blossom Community School Board has agreed to offer the town of Steinsville its elementary school for $1 million. RBB Board President Dana Kerr introduced the proposal in last night's school board meeting.
I believe it is fitting to offer the property first to town of Steinsville and Bean Blossom Township, as they have generously given us the property in the past, to work with us in the property in the past.
The RBB School Board voted last October to close Steinsville Elementary School, citing declining enrollment. The school officially closed at the end of 2017-2018 school year. Kerr says the board is already in talks with the Bean Blossom Township Fire Department about transferring a portion of the property to them. The remainder of the property is to be offered to the town of Steinsville. However, Kerr said the sale would need to include a covenant to ensure the property is not used for another school. The closure of Steinsville Elementary is part of a larger plan meant to address the broader needs of the school district. That plan includes building a connector between Edgewood Primary and Edgewood Intermediate Schools. Community member Emily Sulan is still questioning that plan.
A question that's on a lot of our hearts, taxpayers, is with given the drop in enrollment this year, is that being considered as we continue the plans for the connector?
Kerr says the connector will house RBB's new STEAM curriculum, which focuses on science, technology, engineering, art, and math.
We do not have enough room, even with the decline in enrollment, to create those spaces in other parts of the buildings. So we do still need the connector.
Assistant Superintendent Larry Sanders says the connector will also allow for the expansion of RBB's robotics program to younger students. While he acknowledged Salon's concern, he said the hope is that RBB can attract more students with high-quality facilities.
And we have to make sure that we're preparing our students for the future. And so I really believe that this is a huge investment to the future of RBB schools.
The RBB School Board unanimously agreed to accept a bid from Strausser Construction for the connector project. The $5.3 million project includes the building of locker room facilities at Edgewood High School. George Link, Vice President of VPS Architecture, told the board both projects should be completed in the summer of 2019.
The Bloomington Redevelopment Commission has approved a $29.5 million bond that will fund a new 4th Street garage. A review by structural engineers earlier this year revealed serious structural issues with the garage. The city has already spent more than $20,000 in emergency repairs. Instead of spending more money on repairs, city administrators are moving to replace the 352 garage space with a new 600 space garage. The bond will be issued for a maximum of 22 years, with the city making payments of approximately $2 million a year. The Bloomington City Council still has to approve the bond. $18 million of that funding could go to create a new 400 space garage in the Trades District downtown. Bloomington Parking Commission Chair Jim Blickensdorf took issue with the new Trades District garage. He argues the parking needs of that area, which is still under development, are not yet clearly defined. In speaking to the commission last night, he referenced the parking study the city commissioned from Desmond Design.
Although 1,500 spaces are anticipated, they probably won't be needed until 2026. And so, you know, if this garage were approved, probably wouldn't come online until 2021, same time the hospital site might come online. And then there'll be additional inventory in 22 or 23 when the convention center is built. So I don't know, if we build this garage and it comes online in 2021, what do we do for 5 years while we're waiting it to fill?
Parking Commission member Steve Olin said, quote, "Parking is the lowest and worst use of land." He said instead of building a new garage, the city needs to consider ways to incentivize people not to bring cars into the city. Sustainability Director Alex Crowley says city administrators aren't trying to solve citywide parking problems. They're simply trying to, quote, "activate the Trades District."
You know, having been on the front lines of both the inputs that went into the Desmond study and the front lines of what it's already taking and what it's going to take to attract the right kind of businesses to the Trades District, I can assure you that the need for some amount of city-led parking, again, we're not trying to solve for all of the parking, potential parking needs that ideally we get from all of the, you know, workers that we ideally get in the district, but some amount that we need to lead with to activate the mill, I think is, I can't understate the importance of that. In every single discussion that I've had relative to someone who's looking to invest in the Trades District, one of the first questions that comes out of their mouth when they say, what's the parking situation?
Blickensdorf asked the commission to take more time to consider whether a Trades District garage is needed. The Redevelopment Commission approved a resolution that begins the project review and approval process for both garages. However, it does not authorize any work or expenditure of funds at this time. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Leanne Murrows.
And I'm Don Guerra. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar-powered generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill asked the Supreme Court on Friday to review parts of a state abortion law previously ruled unconstitutional. As WFHB's Annie Aguiar reports, the case could be used to challenge the core of the landmark Roe versus Wade decision.
1 week after the confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh, Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill wants the Supreme Court to review and potentially reverse a lower court's decision on Indiana abortion law. In April, the Seventh Circuit Court struck down two provisions of Indiana's House Enrolled Act 1337 as a result of the case Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky versus Commissioner of the Indiana State Department of Health. Don Johnson, former legal director of the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League and a professor at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law, says that Attorney General Hill's timing isn't ideal, given how recent Kavanaugh's appointment was and Hill's own allegations of sexual misconduct.
Well, I think it's particularly awful that our Attorney General Curtis Hill is rushing to ask the Supreme Court to take away women's fundamental rights when he is working generally under a cloud where his own political party, the Indiana governor, has asked him to resign because of his highly inappropriate sexual misconduct with women. And so I think it's important for people to remember that this is an assault on women's fundamental liberties, and we need to think about it in that way. And we would not be at this point if the Republicans in the Senate had not politicized the last two Supreme Court appointments.
Part of the law Attorney General Hill wants reviewed prohibits abortions at any time, including before fetal viability, if it's for a particular reason like sex, a diagnosis of Down syndrome or other conditions, or race, color, or national origin of the fetus. The district court ruled that these non-discrimination provisions violated a woman's 14th Amendment right to privacy, which has been used to cover a woman's decision to terminate her pregnancy or not since 1973 with Roe versus Wade. In the appeal filed last week to the Supreme Court, Indiana's counter to the non-discrimination provision being struck down is that not regulating these abortions results in, quote, eugenic manipulation. Hill's appeal argues that the abortion rate for babies with Down syndrome is climbing with technological advances in genetic testing, and also expressed concerns over sex-selective abortion. The provision sounds like other anti-discrimination policies, but Johnson argues that the language of the provision makes it particularly offensive and extreme.
It is disguised as a civil rights statute. It targets the core of Roe versus Wade by banning a woman's right to make her own decision early in pregnancy, by banning certain reasons, and it is really trying to disguise that as a civil rights statute by banning abortion for reasons of race, sex, disability, national origin. It has a whole long list that tracks civil rights statutes. But really, it's going to the core of Roe and taking away from women their right to make the decision protected under the Constitution based on their own personal, highly private reasons without examination by the government.
Part of the discussion surrounding this provision was that the state would be prohibiting abortions prior to viability. The Supreme Court has repeatedly held that women are free to choose abortion before viability for any reason or for no reason at all, the district court argued, and this provision would place an undue burden upon women seeking abortions. Another part of the law, on the disposal of aborted fetuses, was also deemed unconstitutional. The law would have required that aborted fetuses be either buried or cremated. The district court ruled that provisions surrounding disposing fetal remains must be related to legitimate government interests. Johnson says the law clearly doesn't meet that mark.
So the fetal remains provision is yet another in a long series of restrictions designed to make abortion more expensive for no strong governmental reason.
The state argued that the humane disposal of human remains is a legitimate interest, but the Seventh Circuit upheld precedent and said that an aborted fetus isn't a person. Because a fetus isn't a person in the eyes of the law, they don't have constitutional rights, as Johnson explains.
Embryos from the moment of conception and fetuses have not been viewed as the equivalent of persons under the Constitution or under other forms of law. It's just very dependent on the context, but under the Constitution, the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade clearly ruled what was recognized throughout all time in U.S. history, that it is not the case that embryos and fetuses have constitutional rights. If they did, that would go way beyond giving the government the ability to restrict abortion. It would mean that the government could regulate a wide range of actions by women during wanted pregnancies on the theory that a pregnant woman is actually two people under the law.
In a press release from Attorney General Hill's office, he says, quote, "Nothing in the Constitution prohibits states from requiring health facilities to provide an element of basic human dignity in disposing of fetuses. These tiny bodies, after all, are in fact human remains. Even if fetuses aren't human, the state then points to law surrounding the disposing of other non-human remains, like slaughtered horses, as reasons to uphold the provision." This appeal to the Supreme Court comes 1 week after the controversial appointment of Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Many legal experts think that Kavanaugh would lean towards restricting the right to abortion if given the chance. During Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing, he said that he understands the importance of the precedent set forth by Roe v. Wade. And in his 2006 confirmation to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, he said he would follow Roe v. Wade faithfully and fully. But in the 2017 D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals case Garza v. Hagen, concerning a 17-year-old unauthorized immigrant's right to have an abortion while in government custody, the court ruled to let the girl have one the next morning. Kavanaugh, however, objected in a dissent, claiming that the decision was setting a dangerous precedent of encouraging government detention to obtain immediate abortion on demand. Johnson says that the new composition of the Supreme Court doesn't look good for abortion rights in the country, and that the Indiana law in particular could be used to contest the core of Roe v. Wade.
The status of Roe is in danger. It's, I think, more likely the court will uphold increasing numbers of restrictions on abortion without expressly overruling Roe, at least until faced with a case that forces the court to confront Roe itself. I believe, though, this Indiana law, it's not like a chipping away. This is like taking a sledgehammer to Roe, because it's flatly inconsistent with the fundamental liberty of a woman to decide whether to continue a pregnancy or not. It's fundamentally inconsistent with that to say the government gets to list the reasons for which an abortion will be permitted. That's taken us back pre-Roe to when some states required women to go before boards of men, doctors typically, and explain why they were seeking an abortion and get the board to approve that particular woman. That is the kind of scenario that this Indiana law evokes, where the government says we get to decide. The woman doesn't get to make her own private personal decision. We get to decide what's a good reason for having an abortion, and we have to approve that. And so that is really striking at the core of what Roe protected for women. So it's particularly offensive and demeaning.
The Supreme Court receives thousands of petitions to hear a case a year, and less than 100 are granted. As Johnson explains, there's no real way of guessing if the case is going to go to the Supreme Court or not.
It is impossible to predict whether the court will grant this request to hear the case. The Attorney General of Indiana is arguing there's a split in the circuits, and it's really important to have direction from the court. In fact, the law at issue is clearly unconstitutional under the last 45 years of well-settled Supreme Court precedent, so I don't see a reason for the court to take the case. But with the newly constituted court, with Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, it really comes down to, in part, whether they're looking for a way to restrict abortion rights.
For Attorney General Hill's request for the Supreme Court to review the case to go through, four justices have to vote upon granting the petition. For WFHB, I'm Annie Aguiar.
Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and from the IU Health Foundation, where local gifts stay local, serving patients for a healthier Bloomington.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. I'm John Summerlott. Antebellum Indiana University was a good bit smaller than today. The pre-Civil War campus ran from the railroad, now the B-line, next to Kroger's, over to Walnut Street. It ran from 2nd Street down to 1st Street. Today, we'd see that as from Wendy's to Kroger's, over to Raleigh's, and up to Seminary Square Park. The park is less than a quarter of the original space that occupied, but most of the space was wide open area. College Avenue did not run through the space, it only ran to the college and stopped. Students and faculty were a small group, but they came from near and far. Hometown names such as the Dunns, the Maxwells, and the Buskirks appear often in the early records. Out of convenience, they likely would have attended no matter who was president of the faculty, and also because of their family connections. But in the early 1800s, college presidents often had very devoted followings. For those living in Northern Virginia and what is now West Virginia, the nearest college may have been Washington College or Jefferson College in Pennsylvania. If so, the capable young president, Dr. Andrew Wiley, was a bit of a rock star. Wiley had been president of them for a combined 17 years. So when Wiley left them for Indiana University in 1828, many students literally packed up and moved with him to the wilds of Indiana. Some of those students were from prominent Southern families. The Wise family of Virginia had held multiple state and federal leadership roles, including ambassadorships to various countries. Just before the Civil War, Henry Wise, patriarch of the family, was the pro-slavery and pro-secessionist governor of Virginia. Wise had insisted his sons and nephews all be educated under Dr. Wiley, which meant traveling west to Indiana University. In fact, in 1850, over 40% of the graduates from IU were from the South. Indiana University was about as far west as one could go and still expect a recognized public university education. The main issue of the institution was not academic quality. It was the Presbyterians and the Methodists battling for control of the technically secular institution. Eventually, the Methodists were unable to secure a professor position exclusively for themselves, so they founded their own school in Greencastle, Indiana. But even the Presbyterians didn't agree with one another, and we ended up with three different Presbyterian congregations in Bloomington. When South Carolina seceded from the Union, the next day, a pro-secessionist flag was flying from the highest point of the university building. Longtime Bloomington residents might remember this building as the Old College Building. The red flag with a white star was torn down by a crowd of students and townspeople. It was dragged to the president's house, then to the courthouse square where speeches were given to denounce it. It was then ceremoniously burned, in case you wondered where most local sympathy fell. Throughout the war, rumors and stories ran wild in the press about Southern sympathizers, known as butternuts and copperheads, living throughout Bloomington and southern Indiana. Reports of rallies and secret meetings were printed in the newspaper, but then often debunked just days later. Not long after the Battle of Fort Sumter, stories flooded Bloomington that a Confederate army had invaded southern Indiana. IU students, Bloomington residents, and Monroe County militia armed themselves with what they could find and headed off to fight the enemy. They made it as far as Mitchell before they found out the stories were just rumors. This left them better prepared for when the Confederates would actually raid Indiana in 1863. The university managed to stay open throughout the war. Many of the students were just 16 or 17 years old and considered too young to join the fight, but many older students, faculty, and alumni did. This created some awkward moments when former classmates realized after battles that they had been firing at one another from across the battlefield. At home, the IU community stuck together through the war, both physically and emotionally. When former student Richard Wiley, son of Professor Theophilus Wiley, died of disease while serving in the war, Professor Woodburn made arrangements for the funeral, Professor Ballantyne officiated the funeral, and IU president Dr. Nutt led the prayer while the community and students were in attendance.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Annie Aguiar.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is Tal Rothenberg. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Leanne Morrows.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, fairness and accuracy in reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcast of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.